This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Steve Jacob. Steve is the president of the Bridgeport Hospital Foundation. He's also the interim vice president of development for Yale New Haven Hospital. This world of development and trying to make sure that revenue shortfalls, a big part of revenues come from grants, charitable gifts, and more. It's become a bigger and bigger part of not-for-profit healthcare. And thrilled today to talk to Steve and shed some light on what the developments are, what he's seeing, and a lot more. Steve, can you take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the foundation that you run and the work that you do?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Glad to be with you today. As you say, I've been delighted over my 22-year career at Bridgeport Hospital and the Yale New Haven Health System to watch the growing strategic importance of philanthropy in our work, both at the delivery network level, that is to say the individual hospitals that care for our local communities, and also at the system level. And our intention to do more system-related philanthropy is one of the reasons that back in July, I was asked to and accepted the position of interim VP of development, so chief development officer at our flagship hospital, Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. And so I'm the first lucky person to have the two campus view of philanthropy in our health system, and excited about the opportunities and possibilities that that will bring. But as I say, I've been doing this work for 22 years here in the Bridgeport area, and now the New Haven area in Connecticut, and prior to that for another 5+ years in private school work prior to coming over to the healthcare sector. So I've been very lucky. I'm born and bred in Connecticut, left for college and graduate school, but have been lucky enough to come back to my home state and work with donors and colleagues for the betterment of our communities. And I tell everybody I have the best job on the planet, and I really believe it.
See, it's a magnificent thing to do something that's truly a labor of love and lines up with your sort of passion, your mission, your belief system, and so forth. Just magnificent. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, we see at least at the political level, I see from the local hospitals that I donate to, how much more it's a mix of technology and people. So, for example, there's a constant sort of note about fundraising, not nearly as obnoxious or anything like the ones that come from the politicians, but well done electronic fundraising. Plus, very often a follow-up from the person who's in charge of following up with us about thank you and some human touch as well. Talk about how the evolution of fundraising development efforts are this mix of technology and people. And my guess is how much it still is driven by a people-first approach, particularly for bigger gifts. But give us a sense of what the fundraising environment looks like today.
You know, technology has been transformational in our industry, just as it has almost every other one that I could think of, and certainly has been in medicine as well. But it's important to remember that it is a people business. And so we try to be as thoughtful as possible here at Bridgeport Hospital and now at Yale New Haven Hospital, I believe all throughout our health system, about that appropriate mix of people and technology that you're talking about. I think first and foremost, it's about building a relationship, and you know, high quality, long-term relationships are perhaps supported by and maybe even accelerated by the smart use of technology. But there's no substitute for people sitting across the table having a cup of coffee or a bite of lunch or dinner, and for the development officer to listen very closely to the story of the donor as it relates to the organization that they're interested in supporting and that we're asking them to support. And COVID has really underscored this, you know, the importance of thinking carefully about this mix. Certainly we had to rely more on technology over the past 20 months. I don't think that option is ever going to go away. I think that, you know, the new world demands that we offer virtual programming and activities. But I know that I really miss spending time in person with our donors. And we're starting to normalize a little bit on that front. And, you know, as much as technology serves us in the background and to market our programs and stay in touch with a wide and larger number of donors and potential donors, we still spend most of our time thinking about how we can build our key relationships in person, both with the development staff at our two hospitals and also involving leadership, both medical staff leadership and executive leadership.
Two other questions that fall on from this discussion. In most businesses, in most worlds, there's some kind of 80-20 rule where 80% of the donations, 80% of the business comes from 20% of the customers. Healthcare is obviously a different business because it's thousands and thousands of patients that pay the bills as consumers. But in the fundraising world, how apropos that 80-20 concept where X amount of donors donate the vast majority of funds for development? What does that look like today?
You know, it's amazing how consistent our experience is of that 80-20 principle in the work that we do. In fact, you know, if anything, it's more like 85-15 or even 90-10. And that's on the one hand a benefit because we have donors in Fairfield County and New Haven County, Connecticut, who have the capacity to play leadership roles in just about every one of our major gift initiatives, the big ticket campaigns and initiatives that really provide much needed support for our clinical operations and our hospitals. But by the same token, we mentioned technology. Technology is an opportunity for us to build a wider base. And so we're thinking about that as well. I mean, ideally you'd be able to close that gap from 80-20 to, you know, maybe 75-25 or even 60-40 over time, if you were able to message your different constituencies, the different segments of your donor community the right way. That is to say, deliver exactly the right kind of content that they want at the frequency that they prefer, not too much, not too little, and customizing and tailoring your online relationship the way that they would like. And the hope is that if we're able to do that more effectively, that would lead to these in-person opportunities. Maybe they'd attend an educational program, either online or in person. Maybe they'd attend an event recognizing donors. Maybe they'd attend an event where they can meet physician or hospital leadership. And then you begin to expand the opportunities for people to step up and make more impactful gifts because you have engaged them in precisely the way they would wish to be engaged. So 80-20, yes, aspirationally, we'd like to level it out and make it more like 60-40.
And that broader base is important, not just from a fundraising perspective, because that may never change the ultimate dollars. But I mean, aspirationally it would, but it's very important from a relationship and loyalty and feeling that people are part of the Yale New Haven system and the flagship hospital in Bridgeport as well, right? I mean, it's not just about money. It's also about connectivity and loyalty and fierce loyalty to the system.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our patients tend to be our donors and our donors tend to be our patients. And certainly if they've had a positive experience with one of our hospitals, our physicians, our staff, obviously that opens the door to a much more beneficial and mutually beneficial conversation about philanthropy. So yes, I think that our approach to development, you know, also includes that building the base of advocates for our hospitals and people who will feel good about the touch points that they're having with our institution and through word of mouth, you know, spread the good news. Tell people not only about their positive experiences with development and philanthropy, but also say some more about their own story and why they've chosen Bridgeport Hospital, the Yale New Haven Hospital, as their place to receive care.
Let me ask you another question. You're free to avoid answering if you'd like, and completely free to take a pass on the question. Here's the question. I know as a middle-aged person on a good day that this concept of that all of us have some ego, so that when we give a gift, there's this concept of an anonymous donor, and there are serious anonymous donors, of course, but all of us have some ego. So when I give a gift, and I like for the CEO to know that I gave a gift, even if it's small, I can't help myself. It's just the natural ego of the human being. Everybody wants to be their own hero. How many of the big donors truly want to be anonymous, or is that just not human nature, that people are giving from their foundation or giving to their family, and they want some recognition for it? Is that just the natural human nature for most of us, and we can't help ourselves? Or are there a lot of donors that truly prefer to be anonymous?
That's a hard pass, Scott.
I'm just kidding.
Just kidding. I wanted to see how you'd react. So it's an interesting question. And you know, as I think about how the work that we do is changing along with the changing environment, my recent experience actually is that our larger donors are less concerned about recognition than they used to be. First of all, we're doing less bricks and mortar fundraising right now because capital resources are so strained. The pandemic has forced our hospitals and our health system, as it has so many, to be very, very deliberate about which capital projects are funded and green-lighted. A hard look at priorities and making sure that if we do release a capital project, that it's urgently needed in a given time frame. So that whole capital allocation process has shifted the way we do our work and present opportunities to donors. And in place of all those capital projects that we used to be shopping around to the community, there is now a lot more community health conversation, a lot more mental health conversation, trying to engage donors in impacting those areas more than ever. And if they say yes and invite more discussion and more conversation about community health and mental health, they do so without the same expectation of recognition or fanfare for their gifts. I do believe when they say yes to those discussions, it's out of a sense of civic responsibility that's been enhanced and has grown as a result of a public health emergency, the COVID pandemic. And so when we sit down across the table with masks on, or have a conversation on Zoom or on the phone now about these community health and mental health initiatives, people are really in it to improve the health and safety of their neighbors, and not so much about where their name is going to appear on a physical facility or on a donor wall or on signage or on collateral material, which is really heartwarming. I think that's one of the things that really has been embedded in healthcare philanthropy over the past almost 2 years now, is that there are a really large and impressive number of people who just want to give and do the right thing by their neighbors.
And is there more of a sense of, like, because there's this fascinating discussion about wealth in our country, about people wanting to be almost less ostentatious about their giving, or some balance in those things?
Yeah, as you said before, everybody likes to be noticed. And if not so much, you know, with the visibility of signage or donor recognition, traditional donor recognition, they would at least like the leadership of the hospital to be aware of their involvement and aware that they're a major benefactor. And so that's our job, right? Is to understand from the donor exactly how they want to be recognized. And if they say no to the traditional forms of recognition, that doesn't mean that they don't want a phone call from the CEO, or it doesn't mean that they don't want a handwritten note from the physician chair of the clinical service line that their gift is directed to. So a big part of what we do now is, as we move ahead with some of these emerging, I would say, gift priorities, charitable gift priorities for our hospitals, is to be very intentional and deliberate about saying, how do you want to be recognized? And how do you want to be noticed by the hospital and its leadership?
Everybody wants to be appreciated. Even if they're so rich and they're giving a gift, they still want to be appreciated. Everybody's got an ego regardless, right? I mean, you find that with everyone. It's a fascinating discussion. There's nothing wrong with that. But they do want to be appreciated. What is there, like you mentioned, at one point there were just a ton of capital projects. I remember, you know, one religious institution that were involved and you could put your name on almost anything and have it named for you. It was almost embarrassing. But there's all these naming rights and so forth. And how do you look at the naming rights today? And for something serious to be named after somebody today, those have to be either a very special story or they have to be crazy amounts of money, don't they? What do naming rights look like today?
You know, the traditional sort of approach to naming a physical facility, which is probably the most common form of naming in healthcare philanthropy. So your new emergency department or your new neonatal intensive care unit, or if you're, you know, upgrading your procedural labs in your heart and vascular area. These are high visibility, high utilization, high acuity physical, you know, clinical facilities that have long had appeal to individual donors, couples, families, and the kinds of opportunities that you would bring to your longstanding philanthropists and philanthropic families in the area. It used to be you take your project cost and set the naming gift at anywhere between 20 and 25% of the total project cost. You know, and now that these projects have extended to much larger in scale, they're much more costly. We're constantly reminding people when we have these conversations that, you know, renovating a hospital is not like renovating your kitchen or bathroom in your home. There are so many costs that are unique and different in a healthcare setting that add to the construction component of the overall expense. So as you point out, these naming gifts could run into, you know, $5, $10, $15 million very, very routinely. And also, what we strive for is a balanced sort of menu of these sorts of opportunities, so that if those naming gifts for bricks and mortar get really high, that we offer something that's also impactful, that perhaps is a little less expensive, because the goal is always to keep your principal donors engaged and feeling like they're a trusted member of the hospital family, so that you're having open conversation about a wide range of priorities and are listening to their feedback. Interest changed, donor interest changed. And so this is a conversation, and it has to be one that's intended for listening and mutual benefit over the long term.
One more question, and thank you. In terms of, we've talked about naming rights. We talked about the percentage of investments that, or donations that come from category versus category. When you look at sort of naming rights, and, you know, my son's at Tulane University, Paul Tulane, who by all appearances was two things. A brilliant business person and a nasty person is the namesake of Tulane University, you know, and it was, you know, and how much do you worry about, you know, if you had Ivan Boesky wanting to give a big gift back in the day, or Bernie Madoff, or whoever it might be, you know, a Greenwich trillionaire, you know, they're not a trillionaire, but somebody who's crazy wealthy in the area. How much do you worry about the impact that naming might have on people's views towards that? I mean, obviously, you wouldn't do it after Boesky ended up clearly a culprit or Madoff. But how much do you worry about the ramifications of naming something after somebody, and, you know, what that might look like now, 5, 10, 20 years into the future? Or is that something you just really assess when that comes up, if you're worried about, you know, could this potentially have a negative impact on something?
Yeah, well, two things here. I think there's never been a greater interest on the part of the philanthropy teams at our hospitals, in the health system, or executive leadership on making sure there is alignment in the values of the donor and the values of the hospital. You know, in this environment where so much emphasis, correctly so, is on equity in all the important senses of that word. And diversity, equity, and inclusion is a centerpiece value of our hospitals in our health system. We have to bring that lens to the conversations that we have with our donors. And, you know, just as we do prospect research to identify candidates to support our various initiatives, that is to say, we have people who seek and obtain publicly available information to inform the conversations we have with our donors, to prepare our trustees and our volunteers to have those conversations, to help us set the bar at the appropriate level in terms of the amounts we're asking for, aligning not only interests, but aligning values. And so we'll take a close and hard look at the type of business that our prospective donors are involved in, the businesses that they own, the boards on which they sit. Oftentimes, their volunteerism or the other charities they give to reveal a lot about their values and what they stand for. And so there's a lot of behind the scenes and pre-work before we actually have the conversations. Then we should learn a lot about the values of the donor and the alignment of those values with our own in the health system when we're having the conversations. There should really be no surprises, you know, after those discussions are had, and they're often memorialized in what we call gift agreements. And now those gift agreements include clauses that allow the hospital to take action if reputational changes, let's say, or impact to the donor threatens reputational harm to the hospital. So it's a pretty complex set of issues, but one that we take seriously. And, you know, it's not something that we can overlook anymore. It's too important to make sure that the reputation of Yellow Haven Health System and its hospitals remains strong.
I want to thank you, Steve, for joining us today. Just a brilliant discussion on a whole range of issues relating to development and donations, and so such a fascinating area of the world today that's come under more interest, and it's become more important to health systems finances too. So interesting. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to join us again in the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. What a pleasure to visit with you.
Well, Scott, you know, thanks for helping me and my colleagues in healthcare philanthropy shine a light on the importance of the work that we do. My experience is that, you know, my colleagues in this line of work really, really care about our hospitals and about improving the health of the community. We need partners like you to help get the good word out. And who knows, maybe somebody's listening today that will think seriously about their local hospital and helping out where they can.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.